Hello, everyone, and welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast that would like to say, please come back, Stephen D. D'Souza. Please, we really miss you. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir. And it appears that we're not alone in the Crow's Nest studio here, which is an imaginary space between both of our apartments. We happen to have a special guest with us today.
Yes, it's me.
It's him. Why don't you tell us about yourself, mysterious voice?
Yes, my name is Jesse Balzer. I am, a fifth-year PhD candidate now at Indiana University. I study movie trailers. I run Rooting Trailers, the blog slash somewhat dormant at this point YouTube channel, and I love bad movies.
Yeah, well, you definitely came along at the exact right time, I would say. But for the uninitiated, Dave, who are we, and what are we doing here?
Well, this is indeed Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every episode, Andrew and I take a look at a film, discuss it at length, take it apart, maybe find something intelligent to say about it, more often than not failing to do so. But the important thing is that each and every film under discussion must somehow connect back to the film we discussed the preceding episode. And Andrew, what were we taking a look at last time on this little program of ours?
Last week, we were looking at the interminable mob romance, Prizzy's Honor, John Hughes. Since 1985, shall we say, A-list cast with a C-list script, but that also featured cinematography by one Andrzej Bartkowiak, who, no, we didn't follow to Romeo Must Die, we didn't follow to Doom. Instead, we followed up to his 2009, shall we say, origin story soft reboot that wasn't, Street Fighter, The Legend of Chun-Li. And yay. I've got to say, anyone who's been listening to our show for a while knows that we regularly triumph the original Street Fighter as quite possibly the holy grail of absurdly ridiculous filmmaking. I believe, was it episode 3 we looked at it?
It was indeed episode 3, so.
Yeah, so it's nice. It's almost like a homecoming of sorts. Now, whether or not we're going to find nearly as much enjoyment out of this one, well, I guess that's what the rest of the episode will be for. But if you would like to know more about our show and how it all works and check out our full episode archive, head on over to filmstripspodcast.home.blog, and I get a gold star for mentioning at the top of the episode 2 weeks in a row. But David, before we can really get in depth on what it is that we love and loathe about Street Fighter The Legend of Chun-Li, why don't you give us the rundown?
Street Fighter The Legend of Chun-Li is the 2009 film adaptation of the classic Capcom fighting video game, directed by Andrzej Bartkowiak from a script by Justin Marks. The film stars Kristen Kurek as Chun-Li, a young woman seeking vengeance against the seemingly supernatural crime boss M. Bison, played by Neil McDonough. The film was a critical and commercial failure during its theatrical run, and exists in two marginally different cuts. Coming up after Filmstrips, an episode of the original 1956 version of The Price is Right, featuring celebrity players Robert Frost and Gregory Corso.
Well, that film certainly sounds pretty exciting! And I mean, I'll freely admit, we don't often look at trailers, but in sort of in honor of having Jesse with us, and seeing as he is the self-proclaimed king of ruining trailers, we figured it might be helpful to take a look at. So yeah, I definitely watched the trailer. Did either of you?
Yes.
I passed.
Well, so I guess, Jesse, if you're thinking in terms of what do you look for in a good action cinema trailer circa 2009, what are the things that I guess you would suggest it should have?
In 2009, you definitely want a good voiceover, which is something even watching this trailer this time, I was like, oh man, I missed that so much. And you also want to have a lot of strobes and a lot of fade.
Oh yes.
To make it seem like we're falling asleep.
Okay. What about like a Ja Rule song that like kind of loosely ties in with the soundtrack? I think that's the only thing this one's missing, really. It definitely feels not dissimilar from most other offerings of the time. And I will say, like, based on the look alone, this trailer makes the film at least seem kind of watchable.
Yeah, no, for sure. It follows the law of every trailer, which is it's 2 minutes of an hour and a half bad movie, so it's good by virtue of just that. You just condense into 2 minutes, right? So that part's fine.
Exactly.
So yeah, I thought the trailer was pretty good. I mean, it's not bad, and it looked fine. It didn't obviously the benefit of it being the much shorter version of the film is that it doesn't have to show us, you know, so much of the, I think there was barely any dialogue in the, yeah, in the trailer at all.
Yeah, I think Bison gets a line. Bison gives his least Irish line in the trailer, and the rest is yes. The professional voiceover man. But I guess it's difficult because Street Fighter, the Jean-Claude Van Damme, Steven D'Souza joint, that is a film very near and dear to my heart. And I know this film probably isn't going to reach those lofty heights, but based off the trailer, I'm like, it may have promise. But then, as David will probably tell us, simply the film is doomed simply by virtue of the fact that it comes out from Fox Studios in 2009. So, Dave, why is that such a problem for you?
Okay, so for anybody who was around during this period, Fox was under the leadership of one individual by the name of Tom Rothman. Now, Rothman has gone on to actually now head up Sony Pictures, but back when he was at Fox, he is a bit of a notorious figure for basically genre fans. Now, if you know the history of Fox, they have a long and proud tradition of churning out quite a fair bit of iconic genre movies for people to see. Your Alien series, the Planet of the Apes films, you know, many, many great works out there for anybody to check out. The Die Hard films as well. However, in the 2000s, when Tom Rothman was running the studio, it is legendary the number of stories out there about how basically this guy seemed to hate genre movies with a passion and went out of his way to make life difficult for many, many filmmakers who worked on these things. For example, one of the films we covered way back when on the show, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, was a Tom Rothman era production, where, yes, he, along with Sean Connery, gave that film's director an endless hard time throughout the making of it.
That being said, I think history is going to look fondly on League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, simply because had Connery not retired after making it, we can only imagine how bad it would have become.
Fair point. The key thing is, though, is that certainly by all accounts, Rothman, if he was behind a project, like, for example, Master and Commander, he would go all out to help that film succeed by any cost necessary. If he didn't like your project, basically he would drag his feet, interfere endlessly, and basically start making demands, such as, for example, you want to know why there was never any Sentinels in the X-Men films in the 2000s?
Okay.
That's because Tom Rothman quite explicitly said, there will be no giant purple robots in these movies, because he hated giant purple robots. Likewise, why is Galactus a giant cloud in Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer? Well, again, giant purple dude floating in space. Kind of even worse for him compared to giant purple robots.
Yeah, that feels weirdly like in the old Hayes office, the don'ts and be carefuls, where like they have a big chart on the wall. And it's like, it can be a robot, it can be giant, it can be purple. It can be two of the three, but not all of them.
Precisely. But the key thing is that Rothman, during his era, really genre cinema got a real raw deal for the most part. And so the filmmakers in charge definitely were not happy to be dealing with him. And likewise, I think it shows. There is kind of a Fox House style that exists throughout that period, particularly with their action cinema, from things such as Behind Enemy Lines to Mark Steven Johnson's Daredevil, and going forward, that I think really, even by 2009, is still very evident in this particular movie here, which I would say is probably the worst film of the bunch if it weren't for the possible existence of Dragon Ball Evolution, a film which Andrew and I took a look at back on the preceding version of program of the show.
Yeah, and we learned such helpful IMDb trivia as this film set was an abandoned jeans factory in New Mexico. And James Marsden thought that Piccolo was a very Shakespearean character.
But the funny thing is it really does point to all the problems we're going to discuss with that one, because there's a film based on an elaborate fantasy text that takes place all around, you know, basically globetrotting, aliens, monsters, the supernatural. And the first choice was, okay, it's going to be set in an American high school today, because, okay, that makes a lot of sense for that.
Not today, though. It's kind of in the future because the cars look weird.
Okay, fair point. Still,
let's be accurate, David.
All right, let's be accurate. Well, let's think about this. What is Street Fighter as a property? when you're going to adapt it at a studio that, by all its accounts, wanted to make sure that the Fantastic appeared as little as possible on screen.
Well, I mean, this could be a good segue, though, based off, well, what do we remember from the Street Fighter games? I mean, we're all kind of in that same generation. We were all console kids, and I think it's impossible to be, like, in your 30s and have zero familiarity with Street Fighter. Jesse, did you play it often as a youth?
I sure did.
Now, do you recall fondly, you know, say, the gripping story or the deep characterization that came out of those games? Or was it something else that drew you to it?
No. For me, it was mostly the you know, the concert piano. That was the kind of thing, you know, the music that Chun-Li produced.
See, I was, the first time I saw E. Honda do the 100-hand slap, I'm just like, I want to be a part of this canon. What about you, Dave?
I played it quite a bit, and I will admit, I mean, it's not a game you play for the story by any stretch of the imagination, but it is a game filled with a cast of very colorful characters who all have their own weird supernatural abilities, or seemingly supernatural abilities, and who are tenuously fighting against a megalomaniac general who happens to have supernatural powers plus science fiction crime organization behind him in terms of his efforts to dominate the world. It's ridiculous, colorful stuff. And that was the joy of it.
Yeah.
When you're playing it.
And I mean, by that same metric, that's exactly what we got with Steven E. D'Souza's earlier 1994 screen adaptation of Street Fighter, which again, I mean, it's a very thin movie, but it brings all the characters that you know and love there. It revels in its goofiness, and it also has that amazing final performance by Raul Julia, who makes Bison into so much more than he ever deserved to be. But I mean, by that same metric, though, you can describe this film in broad strokes very similarly to how you describe the earlier D'Souza version. So perhaps the operative question is, why is this film so terrible and not fun then?
Yeah, I, you know, the one thing for me, I also love the first Street Fighter movie quite a bit, especially for when Guile gives his big speech to the truth.
Ah, yes.
I think the one thing that I kind of like hang my hat on with that is like, even something as simple as like costumes, for example, like they look like the characters from the movie or from the video game.
Yeah, and there's a surprising attention to detail in that original film where it's not just Easter eggs and fan service. It's just like you can actually look in the deep background and see, oh, all the characters' palette swap variants are hung up on the coat rack and things. Like,
right. It's
not a great film, but it's an amazing one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I think in this one, you see the result. It's just everything is fairly bland, like if the costumes are there at all. I think the one thing that I always remember from the movie is that it seems like pro wrestling to me in some ways, right? Where everyone's always calling each other by their proper names all the time.
and announcing
Paul
the
Rog,
date.
I'm coming
that
for you.
Yeah. And announcing the exact date that they'll get it on.
I think sometimes they almost have to do it because, like, nobody's dressed like you remember them from the game, so of course I don't remember. I got lost. Who's who again?
Yeah, it's like, okay, there's Vega because he has a claw.
Right.
Balrog isn't wearing gloves, and I don't remember Bison being Neil McDonough, so I'm lost from here.
Well, and I think this speaks really to again, that Fox mindset of, we're going to crank out a fantasy action movie where we don't want to spend a lot of money on it, because from what I can tell, the reported budget of this film is about $18 million, which I think is substantially less than even the 94 film had. And not only that, but it's going to be follow in that Fox mold of nothing too fantastic. Oh, and by the way, people really dug Batman Begins in its quote-unquote grounded take on The Dark Knight. So we're really going to take those elements and we're going to apply them to this wild, fantastic, colorful universe. And yeah, the end result is really just a super generic martial arts action film, which hits most of the cliche bits you would think are going to be there, except much dumber and with less style than you would hope.
Well, yeah.
The course of it.
I feel like Andrzej Bartowiak took a look at the first Street Fighter movie and said, you know what would make this film even better? if it was a bit more realistic. And I think that was like the initial thought going into the making of this film. Because I think you're right. Batman Begins, for better and for worse, seems to exist to have convinced studio executives that, yeah, people like fantasy as long as it's plausible. And that ended up leading to this wave where every film had to be grounded. But the problem is, like, some texts don't need to be grounded, and after a point, like, trying to give pseudoscientific explanations for, you know, why love is the fifth dimension in Interstellar and stuff like that, just the more you double down on trying to do that, all it ends up doing is highlighting how ridiculous what you're doing is. It's like how camouflage works when you're in the jungle, but the second that you step outside of it, it has the exact opposite effect.
Yeah, no, I mean, that makes absolute sense. And I mean, really, it's frustrating. And I don't think you can necessarily blame the director in this instance entirely for it. Because the interesting thing is, I am not going to make any claims for him being an exceptionally talented or great director. But let's think about it. He got this job probably most likely because he directed the adaptation of the video game Doom. Also not a great movie, but it is more competently put together, and there is far more effort to at least appeal to some of the core aspects of the game in that film. In particular, probably the best sequence of it being the POV shoot sequence.
Which is
a pretty solid sequence in an otherwise fairly mediocre movie. And you would sit there and think, okay, you know, maybe he learned his lesson. Here, I feel like he must have been hamstrung from, like, the beginning of this with people just telling, no, this is what's going to happen. No costumes, limited amounts of CG animation at any given point. Very little in the way of character development. And you got to bring this in at under 100 minutes max, guaranteed. So, which may not necessarily have been a problem if this film had been, you know, half decent, but...
Well, yeah, maybe that's a good point to finally get into the film proper. So, I mean, one of the interesting things about the original Street Fighter is that, I think as we discussed, it really comes off as more of a G.I. Joe film than Street Fighter necessarily, but it's done in a way that kind of works. Structurally, this film does something very different from the outset, because instead of the story of the world, this is, if the title didn't already make clear, the story of Chun-Li, specifically the legend of her, which I didn't realize kids around campfires everywhere were talking about. And then Chun-Li left Juilliard and took down Bison. And then someone jumps out of the bushes and they all scream. But yeah, so we are introduced here to our protagonist, Chun-Li, played by Smallville's Kristen Kruick.
I would say it probably behooves us to start even further, because before Kruick even shows up on film, we get the childhood of Chun-Li here and how this she got her start in her very idyllic family life with her businessman father. And if you want to say what business, I don't know.
He has contacts. We know that much.
Yeah. But yes, he is a businessman who, as we note, apparently on the weekends likes to relax by doing various martial arts out in his very opulent garden with his wife looking on. And the servants all just sort of being, this is a good man. This is a good family, I guess.
Yeah, the only thing missing from this opening is the dad mentioning to his wife, like, I can't believe in 2 weeks I'll be retired and we can live in serenity forever.
Precisely, and I mean, it doesn't help that the voiceover narration Kruick is giving describes this as a fairy tale life, which, like, yeah, thanks for adding that. But Jesse, how would you like to explain what happens to disrupt this fairy tale existence for Chun-Li?
Oh man, I'm I'm drawing a blank. Oh no.
Yeah, honestly, because it's that memorable. A bunch of goons show up in her foyer, and then she's sent off to bed while Bison and his henchmen, they kidnap Father for his amorphous business connections, which somehow is going to be instrumental in Bison taking over the criminal underworld.
But the thing is, I mean, we really need to give the sequence its full due here, because...
You can go right ahead.
This isn't just a case of they show up and they kidnap random businessmen, because instead, you know, random thugs and Michael Clark Duncan as Balrog, who
Oscar-nominated actor Michael Clark Duncan... Sorely departed.
Yeah, who shows up here, you know, as Balrog. He's not wearing any boxing gloves. He is not a former boxer who's, you know, had his career sidelined by Bison, that we can figure out. Nor has he gone on to become a camera person working for a cable news company, sadly. No, here he's just generic henchman. And following arguably the best fight in the film, in which the father gets into fisticuffs and actually manages to use alcohol to light a chain on fire. Yes, he is taken down, and in one of the few laugh-out-loud moments in this movie, young Chun-Li comes downstairs to see what's going on, and then her hair quickly just sort of has air blow by it as Bison dramatically walks into the room with a camera pan over to him. And, oh boy, first of all, I'd like to say this is the point in which the true hero of this movie enters in. Yes, Saint McDonough himself appears on screen here doing the Lord's work of taking on terrible roles in movies so that other actors don't have to sully their name by being in them. And he then starts to go with, we are introduced to probably one of the more peculiar choices made for this movie, and that is Bison's Irish accent.
Yes. Now, I think we could probably spend a good hour just talking about the logic of M. Bison having a delightful Irish brogue. I mean, it's not quite Chief O'Hara in Batman 66, but it's not all that far removed from it either. It is maybe the most distracting thing about this film.
Well, it's the thing. When it's introduced, okay, it's a choice. I don't remember Bison being Irish in the games. Please feel free, Jesse, to tell me if I'm wrong on that one, if you remember. But
I mean, you can read the text boxes with an Irish accent. The world'll bow before shadow lose might.
And we just lost our Irish audience.
All three of them, yeah. Sorry, folks.
Yeah. But the key thing here is, as we get into the backstory of Bison, what will become very apparent is that this Irish accent choice that Neil McDonough makes zero sense in terms of the diegesis of this movie. This has no point in being here unless you just assume that Bison is deciding for no discernible purpose that to connect with his Irish roots, I'm going to speak with an accent for no discernible purpose for the rest of this film.
Well, maybe. Honestly, given how haphazard this film is, I can easily see Neil McDonough being like, wouldn't it be funny if I did this? And everyone's like, yes, go with it.
Absolutely. I just imagine somebody told him, it's like, well, he's, you know, his parents were Irish and we don't have a script yet. Will you sign on to do this movie? And truly in a moment of sainthood saying, yes, we can't subject any other actors to possibly signing on for this role already.
Yeah, I'll do the patron saint of typecasting. But, I mean, already, though, in that opening bit, we can clearly see this is aiming to be a different film than DeSouza's, because instead of a whole bunch of very cartoony characters screaming at each other and using cable news to cut wrestling promos on one another, instead we get, yes, idyllic childhood, Chun-Li playing piano, and a villain that looks like any generic businessman post-2000 in a film.
It's the same thing. What kills me is this is the exact same choice they made with Dr. Doom and Tim Story's Fantastic Four movies, where it's like, well, okay, he's a leader of a nation, he's into the mystic arts, he's a scientist, and he's covered head to toe in armor. How do we adapt this to screen? Corporate CEO. Got it. Yeah. And exact same approach here is effectively what they do, except at the very least, when, you know, Dr. Doom ends up with some form of superpowers, they at least explain that. By the end of this film, I don't know where Bison got his amazing strength from, but
probably the same place that Gen and Chun-Li were able to summon their fireballs from.
Fair point. But yes, so with her father kidnapped, you would assume at this point in time that this is going to start a lifelong crusade on the part of Chun-Li to go get her father, right?
You'd think so.
No, but what does it actually turn out is the case, Jesse? In this sense, what does Chun-Li go on to do?
To sit in an alleyway for a long period of time and pretend to be one of the citizens of... Oh, God, where is it? Thailand? Yeah?
Yeah, it's Thailand. I think it's Bangkok. But, yeah, because we get that interlude of her growing up and becoming an incredibly talented piano player. Because, I mean,
yes.
It's not enough to be a fine martial artist. You have to be sensitive, too, because the real power comes from within. And then we basically hang out long enough to see her mother die of mystery movie illness, and then she finds a mysterious scroll.
Yes, which is left to her at her concert performance, where she can't read it, and along the way home encounters some random individual getting beat up on the tracks where nobody bothers to help him. Again, I don't know Bangkok. I don't know whether, Shanghai, I believe, at this point, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't know if the director knew at that point, but go on.
Yeah, either way, I'm not sure if that's really an issue where people can just get beat up and nobody jumps in or not there, but that seems to be the case in this instance. So, yes, with her mother dead, she decides to go and find out what this mysterious scroll is. And Andrew, where does this quest to understand the scroll take her?
Okay, now I have a question for both of you guys, because
sure.
my copy of this film was not subtitled. And at first I didn't think that was a problem, because it seemed to be mostly incidental dialogue, where you can figure out, oh, that guy said a word I don't know, but he was nodding and pointing, so he's probably saying yes over there. She ends up going into some random mysterious bookstore and bringing this mysterious scroll to an elderly woman at the counter, who then proceeds to talk about what this scroll says. And none of this was subtitled, and I had no idea what was going on. Is it subtitled or not?
It is subtitled.
Okay. Then don't ask me what happens next.
Did you want to take a stab, Jesse?
You know what? I don't remember either, and I had the subtitle. I do not remember what it said.
Effectively, it is... There is basically... This is all about this ancient organization... that's seeking you out and that will put you on a path, but you have to let go of everything that belongs to you in order to go find this out and find Gen. Yes, the mysterious individual who was the man getting beat up on a platform with a spider web tattoo on his hand. And in order to do this, she must let go of everything, which means she dismisses all her house servants and decides, yeah, I'm just going to leave my career behind and take off to Bangkok to live on the streets because some random individual gave me a scroll and told me to do so.
Now, two questions already in my mind. One, I mean, I'm a proud socialist. It seems to me that the nicer thing would be for you to leave the house but let the servants just have it. Unless, you know, we want to make sure there are other people that Gen can recruit into his vagrant army. Second, again, no subtitles. Is it ever indicated who gave her the scroll?
It's supposed to be Gen himself, because as near as I can figure, that's all the only thing that makes sense. But that will open up a whole nother set of questions we'll get to once we meet him proper and what his actual friggin' plan is.
Yeah, because I definitely, when watching this, I'm like, all right, there's a lot of talking. I feel like it should be subtitled, but I don't know how to turn them on. Oh, and now she's talking about how the scroll was right. And the next thing I knew, I was living on the streets amongst the people. And I'm like, well, I feel like it would make more sense if I knew what that scroll said. Because you're right, the next thing we get is her dirty and starving on the streets of Bangkok.
But while this is going on, what's happening at Base Shadaloo?
Well, Bison is putting his Iago-esque plan into motion. Because we next see him greeting everyone in the boardroom, telling the heads of all the other organized crime families that it's been great working with ya boyos, but we won't be working again in the future. And everyone angrily storms out. You think it's going to be, you know, either De Niro with the bat in The Untouchables or Joe Mantegna's attack helicopter from Godfather Part 3. Everyone indignantly walks out. And then we see maybe the only character that looks like he does in the video game, Vega, drop down from the shadows with his claw hand And then as we hear people being stabbed to death, we see Bison sitting at his table sampling the wine. Whoa, this guy's like Hannibal Lecter. He's the Iceman.
Jeez. Well, and this is the thing. And if this is reminding you of, say, the scene in, say, Fantastic Four when Dr. Doom kills the board of directors who kicked him out of his own company, or the scene in Spider-Man when Willem Dafoe decides to kill the board of directors who have kicked him out of his own company.
I sense a pattern here.
Yeah, you're not wrong here. This seems to be along that train ride. Granted, more organized crime families in this instance, but as this film will go to point out here, organized crime, corporate criminals, they're basically the same thing in this instance here.
Yeah, but all this to say, though, it ends with literally the heads of all the families being found arranged in tableau in a freight container in the dockyard. And sadly, this doesn't bring Officer McNulty to the scene. Instead, we're introduced to, I guess, the other facets of our protagonistic Crystal. We get introduced to Maya and Nash.
Oh, boy. So, I guess let's start with Maya, because I don't think there'll be much to say there. It's Moon Bloodgood, and she has nothing to do. There, I've told you everything you need to know.
Yeah, and according to Wikipedia, Maya is supposed to be the character Sea Viper from Street Fighter Third Strike Alpha. I don't know, and I don't really care. And then we get Nash, who is played by Chris Klein. Yes, that Chris Klein. Showing that clearly the post-American Pie years have been very good to him indeed.
Well, and I'll toss this to you first, Jesse, here. We need to make a decision. Is this performance on purpose, or is he really that oblivious to what he's doing on screen here? Because I still can't decide.
No, I would say it's on purpose because it's so consistently terrible. It just seems like a choice to me, and a beautiful choice.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want him to act his character any other way, but like, it does occupy that uncanny valley where it's like, are you self-reflexive of just how awkward and corny everything is, or are you doing that 2009 I'm a cool guy that plays by my own rules?
Well, and this is the thing. Okay, so the character of Nash, now this is based off the character Charlie Nash from the games, who came into existence, I believe, after the 94 film existed. So this isn't, I mean, this is the character Charlie that's supposed to be Guile's best friend, but not in this instance. No, he does not become a giant Brazilian green man who with electric powers, like in the preceding movie.
Yeah, which is sad, because it means we also don't get Dr. Dalsim, which means we also don't get the fat British security guard saying, "Let's see how smart you are when you're not breathing." Oh, what but, might have been. But yeah, that being said, Charlie, as introduced in the film, there is no canonical ties to Guile, not even one of those corny, like, insider lines where it's like, "Oh man, I just finished 3 weeks at base camp with my new colonel, Guile. He's a total jerk." And then never get back to it. Nope, he's just super cop for Interpol.
Yeah, and basically, as he presents it, I mean, after showing up on the scene, listening to a loud music in his car that he's using for work purposes, because, you know, that's the tasteful thing to do when you're an on-the-job officer, is just show up listening to your rap track cranked up to 11.
I'd say it's more new metal. I mean, it is 2009.
I will admit, like, again, after 1995, my understanding of musical genres starts to blur. I can't keep up with you kids.
Yeah.
And your
did
new
Peter Gabriel
things.
Do any rap metal?
So, yeah, exactly. Is this dub to step? I don't know. The point being here is that, yes, he gets out, and after loudly announcing that he loves his job, he proceeds to start talking about how he's been chasing Bison, and that he's this mysterious ghost who he can never track down or pin down or find.
Yeah. Specifically, Bison is the man who walks between the raindrops, which is one of those lines that's, I genuinely can't tell if that's brilliant or idiotic.
Absolutely. But basically at this point, Nash is just immediately joins up, yes, with the Bangkok PD, to try and track down Bison, who they all just sort of nod along and go, yeah, no, totally. It's this Bison dude, isn't it? Because sure, why not? I guess, you know, no actual investigation really needs to happen to sort of corroborate anything.
Well, yeah, because he's the one crime head who is not decapitated at the scene. So clearly he has to be behind it, right? And we know he's an organized crime boss, despite the fact that Charlie begins his entry into the film announcing that he's never caught him, never charged him, never got evidence on him. The guy is a ghost. The film needs both of those things to be true simultaneously. It's better if you just shut your brain off and go with it. But yeah, so the cops now have Bison on their radar. Chun-Li is starving to death on the street, and Bison's got it made. He's got Chun-Li's dad sitting at a desk doing things for him. All the pieces are there, right? We can move into some action.
Well, you might think that, but two key details here. In the terms of Chun-Li, as it turns out, she, as she states, becomes one with the city of Bangkok, having, you know, learning about how the hardships of life that she didn't understand by her privileged upbringing. So now if you're thinking about lines like, say, in Batman Begins, where Bruce Wayne talks about how his understanding of crime grew more complex and how people would steal out of desperation. Yes, they are directly lifting from that movie as well now. It turns out that she finally gets to meet Gen after getting into, and I will give the film credit here, an actual street fight with some hoodlums beating up an old man. So, yes, in a film titled Street Fighter, there is an actual street fight this time. So that's one up here compared to the 94 film, and the only one up that we're actually going to give it.
Yeah, it, say what you will, but this film does what it says on the tin. Granted, I mean, I don't know how many street fights everyone just has weapons they can pull out at the ready, or that every strike requires like a 720-degree spin before, but things are happening. And this is about 45 minutes into the film. I would just like to point out, the version I watched, the unrated cut, runs 97 minutes. Prior to this, okay, the first fight scene in the film is a bunch of young people beating up an old man, and then the second fight scene occurs halfway through the film, and it's prompted by another group of young people beating up an old man.
You gotta give them credit. I mean, there's thematic consistency.
Yes, start as you mean to go on. But I'm glad for this scene, because this was the point I was looking at my watch and saying, is something going to happen in this film?
Well, it depends on how you define by happening, because yes, there is this brief interlude of a fight in which Gen finally decides to reveal himself to Chun-Li. And hey, if you're a fan of video game cinema prior to this, guess what? Robin Cho is playing Gen here, so
yes!
Congratulations!
I actually marked out. I stood up on my couch and cheered when I realized it was Robin Cho.
Yeah, and unfortunately, he gets nothing to do, really, in this movie, but at least he knows the kind of film he's in and does a serviceable job in the role.
Great ponytail, too.
That is true. The key thing is we learn that, yes, Gen, in this instance, apparently was a former partner of Bison's who, after learning about just how dark and corrupt things are, decided he needed to start to fight back, and thus dedicated himself to creating an organization bent on taking down the corruption of Shadaloo.
Yeah, what is it, the Order of the Web?
Yes, and you might sit there and think, okay, Order of the Web, he's like creating S.H.I.E.L.D. agents, right? Or putting together a crack team of martial artists ready to take the thing down, right? So far from everything that we actually witness in this film, he has predominantly grabbed people who own bookshops and on-street restaurant vendors who basically agree that when we see somebody in need, we'll be good Samaritans and give them, you know, food. Oh, and we'll get matching tattoos on their arms just to show that we're all part of the same.
Yeah, like, what's the difference between the Order of the Web and, like, the Community Chamber of Commerce, really? Other than the fact that they don't hand out, like, here's this voucher, it's the equivalent of three Bison dollars or whatever.
Well, exactly. Like, there is nothing that this organization does. And what makes it all the more hilarious is that you then realize that basically Gen's plan, as he outlines it, is that he is going to train Chun-Li to be a warrior to, you know, go down and take down the person who, as far as she knows at this point, has maybe killed her father, or at the very least, has kidnapped him. Now, you might be asking yourself, if you're a viewer, a couple questions. One, why was it necessary to get Chun-Li to join in on this organization? Wouldn't it, say, be more suitable to go down and track down natural martial artists or people already in the field or crack commandos rather than your Juilliard-trained pianists?
I mean, hiding in plain sight. By that same token, Gen already knows how to be a street fighter, and he already knows how to throw magic fireballs of spirit energy. What does he need Chun-Li for?
Jesse, you got any ideas?
For the music. I don't know. I really don't. Maybe they had some music they had to read that was like a secret code or something.
Maybe. And like his whole thing, as we've seen in every martial arts movie, we basically get a slightly longer and duller montage of her snatching the pebble from his hand. In this case, like day two is like, you have to let go of your emotions. So I'm going to blindfold you and try and push your face into a bandsaw. I'm just glad that she was prodigious at fighting with her eyes closed, because that movie would have been a lot shorter.
And better. It's like, you wouldn't see the twist coming. But in this instance, but yeah, so while this is going on, Gen has wasted time allowing Chun-Li just to wander the streets of Bangkok for no discernible purpose, and now just decides to start training her. Bison's actually doing things that will further his goals. And Andrew, how would you like to explain what Bison's plan actually is?
Well, like any great action film, we come up with like the secret code name slash red herring, and in this case, he's expecting something called the White Rose to be shipped into the harbor. And because Shadow Liu's influence is, total over the country, they're getting the Minister of Customs or whatever to come in and, like, get it through security. How do we learn this?
Oh, you're jumping way ahead, because that's his...
We are not going scene by scene through Street Fighter Legend of Chun-Li.
We're not going scene by scene, but I think it's very important that basically we establish that, yes, his overall plan for Bangkok is to gentrify the slums by basically forcing people out with jackbooted soldiers to force them out of these areas so that they can start building new condos.
Yeah.
So yes, this is the plot of RoboCop 3 once again. And yes, that means that M. Bison is the OCP chief executive.
To the plot of Bullet to the Head. Only that film wins because it's Christian Slater and Mr. Eco killing Stallone's friends so they can build condos. It's just, yeah, we realize for all the... I think the film makes a number of cardinal missteps, but here is one of them, because we realize just how narrow Bison's plans are, to the point where, as far as, like, getting people out of rundown neighborhoods, driving land value up, and then selling it back to the highest bidder... That's not exactly like an evil criminal conspiracy as much as how real estate works.
It is, but what makes it all the funnier is that thanks to Gen, we get Bison's backstory. And this is where the film, if it wasn't already completely off the rails, this is where it goes completely bonkers. Because what we discover is that Bison's origins are his parents were Irish missionaries who came to Bangkok and died when he was young. And based on the actual visuals we see on screen, young means he's an infant when this happens. So, okay, he's raised on the streets of Bangkok. So at this point, if you're sitting there remembering the fact that, hey, doesn't he speak with an Irish accent here? And you're wondering, why would somebody raised in Bangkok and who never didn't speak English growing up speak with an Irish accent? Good on you. You're one step ahead of the filmmakers here.
Maybe it's cultural solidarity. It's, you know, you gotta be true to yourself. And, I mean, it definitely helps him blend in with the local color. I can see him as a youth just walking up and, "Top of the morning, sir. Can you tell me the way to Lumpini Stadium?"
The point being that during this time, Bison, who apparently is such a dangerous individual, but not dangerous enough, decides he needs to undergo a mystic ritual in order to purge his good self, all the good from him. Now, Andrew, what does this mystic ritual involve?
Well, we get a reuse of the cave set from Alexander. We see him leading a very pregnant woman, laying her down on a slab, kissing her and then proceeding to caress her abdomen and then drive his hands through it, presumably killing the woman, and it seems like the child as well. But then we realize this is like some weird quickening exercise where he has rid himself of his conscience by placing it in the child?
Yes. So you might sit there and think, okay, he's purged, all good from him. Now, a couple things you might think. One, if you make the choice to take your pregnant wife to a mystic cave and then kill her in the process of transferring your good nature into your her unborn child, maybe you didn't have much of a conscience to start with.
Yeah, that's, I think, a very operative question. Second, it's never really established why him having a conscience is such a problem. And I mean, I only bring that up because this ends up becoming very operative to what this film generously considers a plot. And none of it makes any sense at any stage of the game.
Well, what it even makes it even more baffling is that when you sit there and think, okay, when you sit there and talk about somebody, you know, undergoing supernatural rituals in order to rid themselves of something good, you might sit there and think that Bison maybe has some evil mystic plan that he's up to. And again, he went to all this effort so that he can carry out evil real estate deals.
Yeah, he wants to be a slumlord. That is his goal.
I mean, say what you will about Bison in Street Fighter 94. That man had ambition.
Yeah.
I'm going to take over a country. I'm going to print my own currency. I've got a subplot involving another plan to kidnap the queen. I've got another plot where I'm fixing sporting events for no discernible reason. The man had the iron in many fires in that film. So, I mean, this Bison is a bit of a letdown comparatively when he comes right down to these things.
Well, yeah. And so, I mean, like, as a point of comparison, just everything about this Bison is just so drab and flat and colorless. I can see with McDonough's performance, he's trying to do that, like, Mads Mikkelsen icy danger. And instead, it just comes off as boring.
You're not wrong. It really, really is boring. And I feel bad, but I feel bad for everybody in this movie because honestly, nobody gets anything to do. And they only do if you start inventing things like Chris Klein and basically just decide I'm going to go off script and just do whatever I want on film. And everything's going to be fine by the end of the day, which to be fair, I wish more of them had embraced that notion and just gone completely crazy with it.
Well, yeah, because I mean, we said that this is a film that tries to present itself as grounded. But by the halfway point, by the moment you get to Bison's origin, there is absolutely no way that any of this can be presented like plausibly or in the same diegetic reality that we live in. So it's like, what's the point in pretending? Why not just double down on the craziness from frame one?
Exactly. But to return to the point you were noting, Andrew, yes, basically there is this whole White Rose plot involving this mysterious object that Bison once brought into Bangkok.
And Balrog helpfully talks all about it at the top of his lungs in an airport that is absurdly quiet, just so Chun-Li and we too can understand this is a pretty big deal, which ends up leading to her falling victim to a sting operation, being captured by the Shadow Lao group. But, you know, Silver Linings gets reunited with her dad.
And we can't forget that immediately before that, though, she decides to get more information by going to a nightclub and attempting to seduce one of Bison's underlings, who, oh man, where do we even begin with this scene? Because arguably it's the most visually interesting. Arguably?
Well, in that things happen, and as Jesse brought up, you know, that post-2000 strobe lighting, it's not just for trailers, because it's basically going throughout this scene. It's like if Black Swan was a lot worse, and the dancing was even less coordinated. Yeah, we get the amazing, to borrow a phrase from pro wrestling, the lesbian pollen scene. Where, like, yeah, we discover that the girl she's shadowing, I don't even remember if the character has a name, but she, they're in this hot nightclub, Insomnia, and then we realize through the eyeline magic, She seems to be taking in the young ladies on the dance floor. I wonder why. But it's like through sheer force of will, Chun-Li has discovered she can make herself desirable to lesbians.
Which, if you're sitting here thinking, okay, this is a terrible setup for a scene to start off with, but at least with the right actor, you might be able to pull this off, right?
Yeah, they don't have the right actors.
Yeah, no, in this instance, we have Kristen Keurig, who, again, her trying to look sort of willful and powerful and mysterious and enticing is basically the exact same look that she has in her face at any other given scene of the movie. And I don't understand why anybody would be immediately taken with her. This is also a scene which has the excuse to give her something of a game-accurate costume.
Electric blue.
Yes. Yes, it's a shade of a color that was used in the game. Therefore, see, that's a nod, folks. Yay.
Yeah. Though it does lead to the bathroom fight, and I think you guys are of a different mind, but I actually didn't mind so much only because there's color, and it breaks up the visual monotony of the rest of the film prior to this point, because everything else is just harbor front scenes and black SUVs and guys wearing sunglasses indoors. Here, at least, you know, you get that yellow light, you got the greens and reds. It's nowhere near as pretty as the video game, and it's nowhere near as visually colorful as De Souza's version. But this, I would say, is the scene where it comes closest.
Any response from you on that one, Jesse?
Yeah, so a couple of things. One, like, yeah, she not only has her blue, but she her like her trademark electric blue. She also has her buns now.
Oh, yeah!
Which is very important, which I was a fan of. The other thing that I thought was amazing was when they show the outside shot of the club, the Insomnia Club, the font on the sign for the club is Toys R Us.
Yeah, they probably,
which I thought was terrific.
Maybe they bought the property at a real low price, thanks to Bison.
Yeah,
it's one of those things where we're being told this is a trendy hotspot, and our eyes are telling us the very opposite.
Yeah. Also, the when they are doing their mating ritual dance thing, they have a song playing, and it literally, it's some kind of rap song. I don't know. They censored parts of it because it's, like, there's blank spots like you would hear on a radio edit.
Yeah. They actually,
which is amazing,
the radio
it sounds like
edit.
It's skipping. Also, it's an adult club. Everyone there's 21 at least. Like, you're yeah. a naughty word or two.
And I'm watching the unrated cut of this film, and they still have the edit. Which, yeah. I mean, I think that's kind of that film in a nutshell, where it's like, hey, we got this edgy, high-energy track, but we also have to completely interrupt the flow by blacking out, right. like, every fourth word.
Yeah.
It was like, yo, all you mother in the street fighting club! Mess with me, you're gonna get hit. I'm not talking that. I'm Chun-Li, and I'm here to say. Yeah. That being said, they do repeat the word Street Fighter in the rap, and that's always welcome.
It's, so good. It's like basically the chorus of the song is Street Fighter! Street Fighter! Oh, I loved it. Oh,
I know. They should have just sampled Street Fight and Man over top of that, and boom. We got ourselves a club jam.
Yeah, but that probably would have required 2/3 of the budget to get a Rolling Stone song on this thing.
Yeah,
so
that's
true. I can understand why they did it.
Yeah.
But the thing...
So instead, the club scene is interrupted, though, as Chun-Li ends up squeezing the assistant for information. Coincidentally, right as Nash and Maya hit the scene, because even though Bison walks through the raindrops, we also know that he likes the nightlife and apparently comes to this club a lot.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Big gun battle. We get that bizarre cutaway of Chun-Li straight up shooting a man in the chest. Nobody comments on that at all.
Well, she's a Juilliard-trained pianist. They get prepared for this kind of thing, man.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you gotta have ice blood running through you. So.
Yeah, something else we learned from Black Swan. But yeah, so, like, honestly, this, more or less, is just a setup so we can get that really tasteless scene of Bison beating the ever-loving bejesus out of his assistant woman. And that scene makes me uncomfortable because, I mean, I don't like seeing violence against women on screen. It makes me even less comfortable when I feel like we're supposed to, like, it's presented almost like it's supposed to be a gag.
Well, yeah, it's, you're not wrong, because basically we have Balrog beating on a punching bag in the background, and we don't see what Bison's hitting, and it's not until we start seeing the blood splatter come back that, yeah, we realize, oh, it's a person. And, yeah, that's, it really is a tasteless scene, and a film that is generally tasteless in other regards, but not nearly as offensively so.
Yeah, and it's like, it's just... This is a film that it's like they realized halfway through, hey, our villain's boring. We need to make him threatening. Let's swing the needle the other way. And yeah, I mean, let's have a shot of him beating a woman's face into a pulp. And then after that, he's going to go blow up an orphanage. It's like there's no continuity between the registers of Bison. So it really feels like, yeah, it's still Neil McDonough, but he's playing two completely different characters in this movie.
Well, then it doesn't help that the final shot is him then turning to her corpse afterwards and saying, you broke my heart, and then kissing her forehead. Which is like, really? Really? Do we need to add that little detail there? Because that's just wrong.
Plus, I thought he didn't have a conscience.
Well, exactly. But the important thing is that based on the series of events, he decides that he needs to send his top operative after Chung Li. And who might that be? Who is he going to pay to go after her?
Oh, man, Jesse, you recognize this familiar mug?
No, I do not.
Oh, Vega, it's Taboo from the Black Eyed Peas.
Oh, yes, sorry.
Yes, the guy with the asinine I like you more than sex appeal from Don't Funk With My Heart. Yep. And as you guys pointed out, this was also around the same time that Will.i.am showed up in X-Men Origins Wolverine. So, yeah, I guess 2009 was a breakout year for Black Eyed Peas on screen.
I think Black Eyed Peas are the reason why I don't remember much from 2009. Because I've shut it out, because I absolutely hate the Black Eyed Peas. I absolutely hate them.
I mean, they're a lot more intelligent than I think a lot of people give them credit for. Like, with that Tonight's Gonna Be a Good Night song, it's useful, because yeah. I often forget all 7 days of the week and the order that they fall in.
I will...
Sure.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
Yeah, so we get Vega dispatched surprisingly easy, and being strung up by his ankles, and disappears from the film from there.
Yeah, that's literally it, and it blows my mind. It's like, okay, you went out of your way to cast a celebrity in this role, you build him up to be Bison's dangerous right-hand man, and then he's taken out in a ridiculous moment that would have felt completely appropriate in, say, the Shaquille O'Neal Steel movie from back in 1997.
Shaquille O'Steal.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like, oh, you've got to be kidding me. So yeah, that's it for Vega from this movie. And you would sit there and think, okay, maybe he's going to come back for the big climax. And, you know, there's going to be like, he'll be really super angry and it'll be a real big fisticuff showdown. No, he's just gone.
Yep. Well, maybe he rehabilitated. The system works. Also glossing over, we think Jen is dead at one point because Balrog blows up his tiny little lean-to with a rocket launcher. Chun-Li finishes her training and can now summon spirit fireballs. That is never explained by the dialogue or narration. And then, yeah, Chun-Li is reunited with her father simply so Bison could snap his neck in front of her.
Yeah, so, and with that, she then escapes Bison's clutches and heads back home to discover that, yes, Gen is still alive, because apparently we were supposed to care. Or something. But yeah, at this point in time, you know, the film is now getting ready for the big showdown where she needs to save Bangkok. And we should also note that there are half-hearted efforts to make it seem like the people of the Bangkok slums are really taken in by Chung Li and what a hero she's becoming to them, like she's an urban myth type thing. Again,
legend has it that every month on the full moon, a young Westerner is going to wander through the streets and really hope that someone will give her free food.
Exactly. It's bad. I mean, but the key thing here that it looks like it's time, you know, to really take care of this whole White Rose situation. So yes, you know, on the day where it's going to go down there, she turns to her chief ally in fighting the situation, Jim Gordon. I mean, sorry, Nash. Nash, who is going to help her take down Bison and his crew. This after Nash and Maya already had their entire operation shut down by hires up in Bangkok. Because, yes, Bison's that powerful that he couldn't have done this right from the get-go.
Yeah, we just get that wonderfully economical scene of all the police officers holding boxes of their stuff. And orders came from on high, we're off the case.
Which begs the question of why are they taking the boxes? Presumably, you're not being asked to leave the office. You can stay there. Your stuff was there to begin with. Like, where are you going with it?
Oh, just two floors down. Floor 7 is Bison exclusive crimes.
I see. we're now part of Vice Squad, so go nuts there. But yes, sorry.
Well, I mean, all this comes to a head, and we discover that the White Rose is actually just Rose, who is also white, Bison's daughter, and the holder of his conscience, and has, like, a Lithuanian accent or something?
Well, again, let's start pulling apart these strands of what the hell's going on here. Because, A, when did he lose his daughter?
Yeah, I think, okay, because he talks about how, like, she is also the most important thing in the world, and that if anything happens to her, like, that's his one weakness. He carries her locket around. How did this child get out of your possession in the first place? Because, I mean, I know the mom didn't file a custody order because she's clearly dead. So, what? It's this all-important super thing that's like the linchpin to your criminal enterprise. And, oh, I just flat-out lost her.
On top of which, again, why is he carrying around a locket of her as well? Because you would sit there and think, didn't you purge yourself of all your conscience? In which case, why would you care about the small child who's your daughter? I mean, that kind of seems to go against these sorts of things.
Yeah. And also, if anything were to happen to Rose, like, what would the actual consequence of that be? Does that mean Bison gets his conscience back? Does that mean it's just gone forever? Like, I don't see how any of this matters.
Supposedly, there was supposed to be an extra shot towards the end of the film where following, spoilers, Bison's death, you would see her eyes light up red, and Bison had transferred his essence into her, and therefore he had actually survived, and I guess we could bring back Neil McDonough or recast the role with somebody who would now speak with a Jamaican accent as opposed to an Irish one for no discernible reason.
Nice.
Why not? The key thing...
Yeah, I mean, it was supposed to happen the same way I was supposed to finish my PhD. Yeah, but all of this comes to a head. We get the big... Like, here's the point where it stops being a Street Fighter movie at all. Because most of the action climax is everyone wearing black jumpsuits having a gun battle on a nondescript dockyard.
Yeah. Before moving over to Base Chateloup, where, yes, there's a raid on Bison's compound, and again, now it's the exact same thing that was happening on the stockyards, just with an open gun battle on his property now.
Yeah. Oh, and they have a bamboo pole that they can fight with.
Apparently. And it's at this point we also discover that Bison apparently has mystic powers as well, because at one point he punches Chun-Li and his hand turns kind of translucent, like in the old game where you had, like, the fireball energy thing there.
Oh, yeah.
And
what was it? Yeah, because, the psycho flame?
Yeah, something like that. But it's like, okay, why does he have this? Where did it come from? I mean, even going back to give Street Fighter 94 credit, at least when he starts doing the flying at Guile thing, they at least give a rationale for why he's suddenly able to do that.
And even though it still makes no sense, you have a dying Raul Julia screaming at the top of his lungs how when Lucifer fell from the sky, he came down as light. Here we have Neil McDonough being like, you shouldn't have come into my house. You shouldn't have hurt my daughter. Except it's more like, you shouldn't have come into me house. Yeah, so, I mean, end as you began, and we get a very dull fight scene. We get Bison being thrown. We get, like, the double kill of him being thrown from a great height. Chun-Li jumping down, scissoring his head between her legs, and her twisting so his head comically is 180 degrees reversed.
Yeah. And then Charlie Nash decides that even though he's clearly just seen her commit murder, he's just going to let her go at this point in time before the police show up so she doesn't get in trouble.
Well, because she has integrity. And he's also going to make sure that Rose is safe.
Sure he is. The key thing here is this then brings us back to the end of the movie where it turns out Chun-Li has returned home, where I guess it was more of a, she didn't really give it up. It was more of like a vacationing out in Bangkok for the summer type thing.
I mean, there's giving up and then there's letting someone else use it for a bit.
Yeah. And Gen showing back up, basically asks her, it's like, I need your help. It seems somebody's inviting people to this mysterious tournament that this seems like it might be a bison thing, which A, we just seen bison die, so why would you think that? B, at what point in time did we ever see bison interested in throwing martial arts tournaments as well? I mean, land schemes, okay, you got me. But this just seems, you know, a bit of a leap that you're making here again. And then third, he drops about having her join him to go to Japan to track down this Ryu guy of some sort.
Film does get bonus points. They do not call him Ryu.
There we go. But the key thing being here, Chun-Li then makes that heroic decision of saying, yeah, I'm going to commit to this martial arts thing, and we're going to go travel down and make sure that all the Shadow... Oh, no, wait, sorry. You know what? I'm just going to stick at home for a while. Kick it up, put my feet up. Yeah, so, by the way, you look after Bangkok and see all, everybody. And, yeah, yeah. That's the film!
Yeah, it's just, it's a damp squib of an ending to a damp squib of a film. Oh boy, where to even start? I guess, all right. I think it's safe to say that none of us went into this film expecting that it was going to be great or even good. But I guess, Jesse, my question for you is the film that we got, you know, you don't necessarily have to think this film is going to be a work of art. Based off what you were expecting, though, like, how did this film, in terms of what it is, how did that measure against what you thought this film would be going in? Had you seen Legend of Chun-Li prior to us discussing it?
Yeah, so I saw it initially, like, when it, like, not long after it came out, it played at the, whatever, like, a second run, like, Dollar Theater in, when I was living in Moorhead.
Nice.
So I went to then, and that was the kind of movies I would go see there because they were all a dollar and I had no money.
Okay.
So I had already seen this. This is the second time I've seen it.
Well, that's one more viewing than I'll get. So I guess, like, sort of, what do you expect this film to be, and what do you make of how they chose to present what is nominally a film based on a fighting video game?
You know, the main thing for me about it is that it doesn't capitalize on the property that they have to work with, right? So, you know, something like, even as corny as, like, have you guys done Mortal Kombat? Did you guys cover Mortal Kombat at all?
Not yet.
No, but there's a chance we will be in the future. Okay.
Mortal Kombat is an incredibly cheesy movie, but it actually, they find the equivalent, which should be fairly obvious in terms of, like, a fighting video game. They go, like, let's just make a really cheesy martial arts movie, right?
Yeah.
And this one, they half-hearted. And, like, Mortal Kombat, I think, is actually, like, okay, and this one they don't go full in on it and actually make a competent though corny martial arts movie. They just make a bad action adventure. I think that's my major knock against it. The other major problem I have with it is that half the time the characters say Shadow Lao instead of Shadow Lu, and I don't know why they do that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's also the kind of film where it's this secretive organized crime ring that Chun-Li can learn all about with 5 minutes of cursory Googling.
Yes.
Yeah.
This really does feel like a film at odds with itself because it wants to be grounded and cool and CSI serious while at the same time drawing on these inspirations, and it has no idea how to balance both of those registers. So you get a film that is too stone-faced to be any fun whatsoever, but it still makes nods to the video games only by presenting like fantastical things that make no sense, and just the film chooses not to comment on it. And it's the most curious thing.
Yeah, and also they make the same problem that, like, again, there was, as you mentioned before, like, there's all these reboots of all these franchises around this time, whether it's Batman or James Bond. They're rebooting their intellectual property, but they always reboot it, and then at the end they get to a point, and then they indicate something interesting will happen, and then the movie ends, right?
Yeah.
They're gonna, hopefully they want to make a franchise out of it, but then they don't realize they made a terrible movie, they're not going to make a franchise out of it. It's like, oh, yeah, that sounds interesting. Great.
Here we go again. Yeah, it's just, the weird thing is, like, it's excusable when you're making Batman Begins in the sense where it's like there's a very clear origin for the story and for the character. And I don't think that's necessarily needed for something as porous as Street Fighter. I mean, like, they could have just had this film be Chun-Li's very first encounter with Bison in the context of a Street Fighter tournament. We wouldn't have lost out on anything. We get Chun-Li's tragic story and the legend she became for the people, but I don't think any of it matters, and any of it is significant at all to the character or to, like, the loose world of Street Fighter. So it's like, why give us this origin when everything about it is completely unnecessary?
Right. I mean, it's also, I remember, it's a different example, but I remember years ago hearing an interview with, like, Jackie Chan or something like that, and he said, like, the story of every martial arts movie is really simple. It's like somebody walking down the street, somebody bumps into him, he says, hey, why'd you bump into me? And then the guy's like, let's fight, and then they fight. Like, that's a martial arts movie, basically.
Yeah, and if you do it well, you don't need anything more. Yeah.
I don't know what they were trying to go for with this, other than trying to build a world that they could then make more movies out of, but they failed to make a good one in the first place.
Yeah, the Green Lantern effect, I guess. But Dave, I know that talking about this film without cursing a blue streak has been difficult, but let's start to you. Where do you think that there's any space where this film could have been, maybe not on par with the DeSouza one, but certainly better than it currently is? And if so, what keeps this film from being that?
I will put it this way. A, being at Fox is probably what kept it from being anything remotely entertaining. But I would say that the big problem here is I'm not even going to give anybody involved with this the same, some of the credit that you're giving. I'm just going to say this is a film made with absolute contempt for its audience. And the thing that irritates me more than anything else about this movie is that. It's the thing where it's one thing to be bad, but it's another thing to be made with the basic attitude that who cares, anybody will just eat it up. And what really irks me about it is that if at least the fight choreography and the filming of it and the editing of it had worked, I might be able to sit there and say, okay, it's not the game, but at least, you know, as a semi half decent action film, it was at least half decent. But what blows my mind is they go out of their way. They don't spend enough money to make this a legitimate project. I mean, $18 million for a big fantasy film, it's not going to fly.
Yeah, but John Carpenter's The Thing was made for $18 million 25 years earlier. And even though it's set in the Arctic wilderness, it is so much more visually interesting than this movie.
Absolutely. And the thing about it is they cast quasi-celebrities. I mean, okay, Michael Clark Duncan, I don't know if he was ever somebody you could sell a film off of based on his name alone, but I mean, he's a decent actor. Neil McDonough, he's like your third or fourth choice when you couldn't get the people you were really looking for. And Kristen Keurig, I mean, she was the worst thing on Smallville, and I honestly, this is probably the best project she was going to get following that show, but come on, like, she is awful in this role. But all the money spent securing this quote-unquote talent, and nobody can be bothered to even try and make anything click in this thing. They can't shoot the action well, they can't pay tribute to the games well. It's an ugly looking film from a cinematography standpoint, because the lighting is atrocious for most of it, and flat and ugly and just miserable. And what really blows my mind is then you take a look at the DTV action film renaissance that's been going on for about the last 10 years, where, you know, you have people making these, you know, either sequels to big name films or, you know, just straight to video franchises made for practically nothing at all in terms of budgets. And yet they actually deliver on the goods they promise. I watched a film, around the same time. Has anybody here watched Avengement by any chance?
Avengement? No.
Terrible title aside. And I will admit, it's a terrible title. It is a martial arts film starring Scott Adkins and directed by Jesse Johnson. And it is, whatever else you can say, those are people who are working on a microscopic budget, a fraction of what this movie had with its already low budget. And they deliver a film that is visually more interesting, better performed, and in terms of the action choreography, it delivers in a way that this film doesn't even begin to approach. And again, it's not the only film along these lines where we've seen that happen, where, yeah, these people who are working at the absolute fringes with nothing, their basic attitude is, like, come hell or high water, we're putting on a show and we're going to give them exactly what they paid to see.
Well, yeah, like we've talked about figures like Carpenter, Don Coscarelli, where there's something unmistakable and something, there's definitely a sense of craft on display despite any budgetary limitations. And it almost becomes more impressive because when they realize things on screen, you get the sense that it's because they absolutely were driven to do this. Whereas you never get anything close to a sense of like, yes, this was Andrzej Bartkowiak's, this was his passion project. This is the film he needed to make.
Well, absolutely. I mean, he basically came onto this thing probably because, hey, you made Doom, that sort of made money, so you seem to know something about video game movies, have at it. And probably when somebody up at the top, most likely Tom Rothman, sat there and said, okay, no, nobody's going to be wearing, you know, bright red dictator overcoats in this film. He probably just said, okay, he'll wear a business suit. Rothman said, fine, and he went off and did it. And okay, but that doesn't make you a good filmmaker. And honestly, I don't know. I mean, I don't believe he's directed anything since of any note. And I can completely see why. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing here. And I honestly, everything about this film feels like, look, we just need content to have in the theater in February or January, whenever the hell this thing comes out. It doesn't matter what it is. We'll just crank it out there and they'll pay to see it and we'll make a couple bucks on home video.
Well, they were wrong about that part.
Well, yes. But that's the thing. I mean, that's the level of attitude. And I will forgive films for many, many things if at least I get the feeling that they're trying to do something. And nobody's trying anything on this film. Not at all. Unless your name's Chris Klein. And again, he's just trolling everybody and getting paid while doing it. So
maybe.
Props to him?
Yeah. It's, I mean, I don't know how much more there is that needs to be said about Street Fighter Legend of Chun-Li. It is definitely nowhere near as fun as the first movie, and I think above all, it makes the fatal flaw of being a boring film. It's dull, and when we do get action scenes more than halfway through the film, they are dull. Everything in its presentation is so dull, and life is way too short for bland food, mediocre movies, and banal conversation. And it's like, if you could roll them all into a ball and then rub it in a big vat of mediocrity, like, then you would get something approaching the purposelessness of this film. But that being said, if we all had such strong opinions, that means this next segment is probably going to be a real hoot. Hits and Pits, where we celebrate and condemn the little things. And maybe to start us off, my question for you guys, are there any little aspects of this film that either of you would want to celebrate?
Okay, I got a very small one. The Capcom title card.
Yes.
In the movie was very good.
Yeah, it's the Thinking Man's Marvel intro.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, but you know, it also has the same Capcom logo as the video games did, so it's the most faithful moment of this entire
film. Yeah, and they do a little bit of, you know, a little bit of sound design in there, let you know, hey, video game.
Yeah, not just for kids anymore.
Yeah, I appreciated that.
Yeah, it certainly makes the film feel like it's going to have some promise and immediately undercuts that.
Yeah, if they would have taken, in some ways, like, the energy from that and put it into the movie, the spirit of that into the movie,
yeah,
you might have had some.
It doesn't have to be a clever spirit. It just needs to be, like, big, dumb, colorful fun.
Yeah.
Dave, is there anything that you didn't actively hate about this film while watching it?
I will say it's still terrible, but I admit I've probably had more fun with Neil McDonough's unnecessary Irish accent in this movie than anything else. So that's kind of a positive. I mean, otherwise, I will go on record of saying this is probably, might just be the worst film we've looked at in the show. There are ones that are more blooded, anger-inducing, but in terms of just sheer incompetence and who cares, this movie is just abysmal from start to finish. So, yeah, I don't really have any hits I can give it.
Yeah, I mean, this film, the distillation of this film in one single scene is Bison as with the Van Damme film, standing in front of a model of his city that he is going to design and control, only we don't get an amazing monologue out of it. Oh, what might have been. But then we can move right along to the part that y'all came here for, the pits. The things that we may not have discussed, the puzzling things, the film-breaking things, the things that made us throw up our hands and say, someone got paid to do this. And I'm sure we'll all have a couple of these. So Jesse, as our guest, why don't you go first? What's your first pit for Street Fighter Legend of Chun-Li?
I would say the way in which the fight scenes were shot.
Yeah.
It is. If I were a stunt choreographer on that movie, I would be upset because you cut up. I mean, it could have looked great. Who knows? But they just cut to pieces everything that they did in terms of the physical action. Just cut it up.
Yeah, I think that's fair. When it's a fight movie and you have people that don't know how to string together a fight scene, there's a problem.
And I think the main thing for me of what in terms of that is, and you see this a lot, like with action movies of that time, even now for that matter. They cut for impact rather than kind of rhythm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they're cutting to like show like, oh, someone got hit, but you can't really register it because it cuts away too fast. And they don't cut. The fights don't have any kind of build to them. They just kind of happen and it's percussive in some ways. And then just ends.
Yeah. And it's a ton of very close framing, probably because of stunt doubles being used extensively. But the result is when you have a fight scene, even in a confined space, if all you're doing is shooting in close-up, that necessitates you're going to have like a cut at most every half second. And it just, you can do that in a way where it's hyperkinetic and stylish. This is not a film that pulls that off.
No, it certainly does not. And I mean, There are ways to make it that kind of thing work. And honestly, the dance sequences in Flashdance, probably about the, I mean, if you took that approach to the fight scenes in this film, you might have actually had something until you cut to the point where Kristen Keurig's stunt double has a mustache.
I was going to say, you beat me to it.
But yeah, I mean, that's about the only way the editing could remotely work. And I mean, intensified continuity editing is something in terms of action cinema that's, it's either a blessing or a curse, depending upon how you want to approach. I mean, given the way in which people digest films and the sort of in the ability to sort of register visually what's going on at a quicker rate than audiences of generations preceding, I get why it happens, but seriously, yeah, the long take, just let the performers do their thing, honestly would have been preferable to what we have here. And it's honestly a much better stage or better way to approach things. But yeah, you actually have to cast real martial artists then in your films.
Yeah, I mean, say what you will, but Dragon Ball at least had the sense to get Xiao Yun fat. You know, it's just, I don't. There's too many things to list about where this film goes wrong, but I want to give special mention to the fact that, as a testament to this film's editing, in the climax, we have the cops racing to the dockyard, and you have Nash screaming into his CV radio, like, Bison's going to be at the drop, and we're going to need some backup. Nash out! And then we cut for 30 seconds of Chun-Li doing something. And the very next shot we get of Nash is him getting out of a car, having arrived, yelling into a CB radio, and ending that with Nash out. I feel like that was going to be like one of those dude where's my car lines that really just should have taken off like a rocket in culture. You got kids at the mall saying Nash out to each other every which way you turn. And sadly, it never came to be.
Well, you know, the weird thing, too, is he also comes back to saying he says he loves his job again at the end.
Yeah.
Which is amazing that they didn't put that in the trailer, because that is the old joke about movie trailers. Right? Somebody yells, I love my job.
Exactly. I'm thinking...
Didn't put it in.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's up there with Ludacris in the Max Payne trailer screaming, you're all going to get medals for this! Now, that was at least a video game movie that had a distinctive look to it. Any other little things that we want to bring up and condemn this film further for?
Chun-Li's, the kidnapping of Chun-Li's father, or at least the rationale and logic behind it. Because... Okay, folks, this is the event that opens the film here, which is that, yes, Bison sends his goons in to kidnap her father, And following a fight, he goes with them. Now, the rationale is because Bison wants his business skills and contacts. Here's the problem here. By all accounts, her father has been kidnapped. Nobody sees him. Nobody's heard from him. She's not even sure he's alive.
Yeah, and there are like background, in the background of some scenes, it's like showing news footage, like, businessman has been missing all this time. And it's like, you'd think the moment that he contacts one of his contacts, they might just, like, let the family know, by the way, your dad's alive, he's doing fine.
Well, and you would sit there and think that maybe the actual way he should handle this is Bison kidnaps Chun-Li, or at least her mother, and basically it's like, you do these things for me out in the public and use your contacts, or I hurt them. You know, like any rational, evil person would do. But again, Bison in this film doesn't seem to think his plans through, and you know, therefore, he entrusts people like Belrog and Vega to carry out things for him. Hence, why we have discussions on an escalator where anybody can listen in and tell what's going on, particularly with a very public and visible politician right in front of him.
Well, yeah. And the fact is, Michael Clark Duncan, very large, dark complexioned man with an unmistakable baritone. Yeah, probably going to stand out in a Thai airport. Just a hunch.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, like, it makes no gosh darn sense. I mean, this is the thing where, again, not to keep harping on this, but the overall plan of this is at the heart of this movie. RoboCop 3 did it smarter and better, and that is not something I ever anticipated I would have a chance to say, but that film is quote unquote smarter and better than something
more
else.
Colorful too, and has another villain who has a curious European accent as well, and Rick Torn and Mako. Man, let's just watch RoboCop 3 again.
I'm down for that. But what about you, Andrew? What is something you would like to throw some attention to?
I think the last thing I would just like to mention is I think we can all agree, just how much Chun-Li's voiceover narration adds to the world, really makes her feel like a real lived-in character. Well, no, I mean, it is so impossibly earnest that it's like, this is atrocious dialogue. Kristen Kreuk is not great as an actress based on what she brings forward in this film. You hear that narration, though, and you cannot for a second say that she is not trying her absolute best.
She's trying her absolute best, but the problem is her absolute best isn't much to begin with.
No argument here, but there's something kind of endearing about just, like, how flat and terrible this film is. But then she's like, and then I found myself on the streets of Bangkok. It was a nightmare. But I thought about what my father told me, and I found the strength to go on. It's like, everybody, I'm acting.
Well, I will say this. At least she isn't Allison Mack, and therefore hasn't committed actual crimes that have impacted the lives of many, many people.
Okay.
On that level, I will give her that. So, yeah.
All right. That went in a different direction than I thought it would. But, I mean, as they say, if you stare too long at Street Fighter Legend of Chun-Li, it's only a matter of time before you get into doomsday sex cults and celebrities going to prison. Oh, man. Start as you mean to go on, right? But, okay. Yeah. I think that about does it for Street Fighter. Dave, I'm sorry. I thought that it would be fun to return to familiar territory. It categorically wasn't, though it was nice to talk to both of you about it. Where are we going next off of this train wreck of a cluster schmaz of awfulness?
Well, here's the thing. The frankly forgettable, if not terrible, score by Stephen Endelman here is allowing us to follow him to an earlier fight movie that he had made. One made by a distinctly different filmmaker in this instance, and that would be Red Belt from David Mamet, of all people.
Hell so, yes, we're doing Red Belt.
Yes, so yeah, we have one hell of an episode to talk about coming up with that one, and it will be anything other than Street Fighter The Legend of Chun-Li. We may also have a special guest joining us for that one. provided this time his audio equipment doesn't completely crash and destroy our episode on us.
Second time lucky. So join us next week as we talk about David Mamet's MMA film that also involves Tim Allen, magic tricks, insurance particulars, and, well, Ricky Jay's bound to be there at some point, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, having said that, Jesse, where, if anybody wants to find you, can they find out more information about yourself?
Yes, they can find me at Ruining Trailers on Twitter. I have a private Instagram, so nobody can find me there. And on YouTube, Ruining Trailers as well. There hasn't been anything posted for a while, but been between some technology and stuff, so I got to figure that out. But there'll be more stuff soon.
All right. Well, yeah. Our feverish and rabid listener base will be hounding you night and day until you get some new content. But you can also check out Jesse's blog available through our website. We threw a link up there for all our fellow travelers. And it's well worth checking out because I'll freely admit, not every media project is something I find interesting. But trailers, they're omnipresent. We take them for granted. It's interesting to actually get down to the nitty gritty of how that shapes our expectation of a film. In this case, the trailer made me briefly think that this was going to be worth watching.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Dave, what about you? Where can people let you know that you were categorically wrong and this film is a sleeper classic?
Tom Rothman can attack me on Twitter at 24panels. I don't care. I'll block you. But what about you, Andrew? Where can people contact you?
Tom Rothman can find me on the mean streets of Bangkok. But if he doesn't feel like traveling, he can find me on Twitter at filmstripper. You can also leave some long-form critique by emailing us on the show at filmstripspodcast@gmail.com or checking out our website, filmstripspodcast.home.blog, where you can find everything, every episode we've ever done, all of Dave's episode summaries, links to friends of the show, and our FAQ and A, where we answer a few of your questions that, even if you didn't have them, well, we answered them anyway. And as always, feel free to check us out each and every Tuesday through iTunes or whatever podcasting service you use. 5-star reviews help move us up the promoted chart and get more eyes and ears onto our humble little show. But that's yet another place where you can leave some feedback and let us know what works for you, what doesn't. Because each and every week, all we want to do is bring you the show you want to listen to.
Absolutely. But until then, Andrew, are there any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Why, yes, David, there are. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Then again, you might just get lucky and all monotony will do is send taboo after you. You'll be fine.
Nash out! Too fast, you change your passion for glory. Don't lose your grip on the dreams of the past. You must fight just to keep them alive. It's the eye of the tiger, it's the thrill of the fight, rising up to the challenge of a rival. And the last known survivor stalks his prey in the night, and he's watching us all with the eye of the tiger.